trees greeting overcast sky. A warm New Year's Eve. Shoes at the door. Strings of light and candles and candles and candles. A potpourri of folks in from the 10 directions. And here we sit in the most beautiful basement hall in Toronto. A very warm welcome to the Zen Buddhist temple and to this special service. We've been holding it for almost 20 years, and it's to provide, we hope, a meaningful way for you to embrace this special time, as well as a different kind of year-end celebration. Maybe you'll go to that one next. That's okay, this is a good start. The Buddha teaches us that all things in the world, of all the things in the world, the one with the most powerful influence for both good and evil, is the mind. In the Dhammapada, he says, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. So the Buddha's teachings, by proposing moral discipline and mind culture, these offer transformation for our problems, beginning in our own minds. I always think, you know, what starts in my mind, and this is important, without restraint, goes into my speech. Without restraint, goes into my actions. Restraint is a beautiful thing. It takes a lot of practice. There are two parts of my time with you today. The first is a part that I've been doing ever since we started to do these services, and it's reading a story. It's my favorite all-time story. And so every New Year's I read it, whether I'm here or, as in the case in the past few years, I've been at home in Ann Arbor. There is a story, perhaps a myth, typical of mythic stories. It has many versions. Also typical, the source of the version I am about to tell is obscure. I cannot remember whether I heard it or read it, or where, or when. Furthermore, I do not even know the distortions I myself have made in it. All I know for certain is that this version came to me with a title. It is called The Rabbi's Gift. The story concerns a monastery that had fallen upon hard times. Once a great order, as a result of waves of anti-monastic persecution in the 17th and 18th centuries, and the rise of secularism in the 19th, all its branch houses were lost, and it had become decimated to the extent that there were only 5 monks left in the decaying mother house. The abbot and 4 others, all over 70 in age. Clearly, it was a dying order. In the deep woods surrounding the monastery, there was a little hut that a rabbi from a nearby town occasionally used for a hermitage. Through their many years of prayer and contemplation, the old monks had become a bit psychic, so they could always sense when the rabbi was in the woods again. "The rabbi is in the woods! The rabbi is at his hermitage!" They would whisper to each other. As he agonized over the imminent death of his order, it occurred to the abbot at one such visit of the rabbi to go to the hermitage and ask the rabbi if by some possible chance he could offer any advice that might save the monastery. The rabbi welcomed the abbot at his hut, but when the abbot explained the purpose of his visit, the rabbi could only commiserate with him. "I know how it is," he explained. "The spirit has gone out of the people. It is the same in my town. Almost no one comes to the synagogue anymore." So the old abbot and the old rabbi wept together. Then they read parts of the Torah and quietly spoke of deep things. The time came when the abbot had to leave. They embraced each other. "It has been a wonderful thing that we should meet after all these years," the abbot said. "But I have still failed in my purpose for coming here. Is there nothing you can tell me? No piece of advice you can give me that would help me save my dying order?" "No, I'm sorry," the rabbi responded. "I have no advice to give. The only thing I can tell you is that the Messiah is one of you." When the abbot returned to the monastery, his fellow monks gathered around him to ask, "Well, what did the rabbi say?" "He couldn't help," the abbot answered. "We just wept and read the Torah together. The only thing he did say, just as I was leaving, it was something cryptic, was that the Messiah is one of us. I don't know what he meant." In the days and weeks and months that followed, the old monks pondered this and wondered whether there was any possible significance to the rabbi's words. "The Messiah is one of us?" Could he possibly have meant one of us monks here at the monastery? If that's the case, which one? Do you suppose he meant the abbot? Yes, if he meant anyone, he probably meant Father Abbot. He has been our leader for more than a generation. On the other hand, he might have meant Brother Thomas. Certainly, Brother Thomas is a holy man. Everyone knows that Thomas is a man of light. Certainly, he could not have meant Brother Elric. Elric gets crotchety at times. But come to think of it, even though he is a thorn in people's sides, when you look back on it, Elric is virtually always right. Often very right. Maybe the rabbi did mean Brother Elred, but surely not Brother Philip. Philip is so passive, a real nobody. But then, almost mysteriously, he has a gift for somehow always being there when you need him. Philip is the Messiah. Of course the rabbi didn't mean me. He couldn't possibly have meant me. I'm just an ordinary person. Yet supposing he did. Suppose I am the Messiah. Oh God, not me. I couldn't be that for you, could I? As they contemplated in this manner, the old monks began to treat each other with extraordinary respect on the off chance that one among them might be the Messiah. And on the off chance that each monk himself might be the Messiah, they began to treat themselves with extraordinary respect. Because the forest in which it was situated was beautiful, it so happened that people still occasionally came to visit the monastery to picnic on its tiny lawn, to wander along some of its paths, even now and then to go into the dilapidated chapel to meditate. As they did so, without even being conscious of it, they sensed this aura of extraordinary respect that now began to surround the five old monks and seemed to radiate out from them and permeate the atmosphere of the whole place. There was something strangely attractive, even compelling about it. Hardly knowing why, they began to come back to the monastery more frequently to picnic, to play, to pray. They began to bring their friends to show them this special place. And their friends brought their friends. And their friends brought their friends. Then it happened that some of the younger ones who came to visit the monastery started to talk more and more with the old monks. After a while, one asked if he could join them. Then another, and another. So within a few years, the monastery had once again become a thriving order. And thanks to the rabbi's gift, a vibrant center of light and spirituality in the realm. That's the first part. And in the manner of patched-robed monks, I've patched together a little Dharma talk for the other part. I don't think it can really hold a light to the rabbi's gift story. I will try. To be awake is to be fully and completely embodied. To be fully embodied means to be at one with who we are in every respect, including our physical being, our emotions, and the totality of our karmic situation. Karmic situation, the result of causes and conditions which bring us to this very moment, as it is, in our relationships, in our work, in our spiritual life, in the world. I was getting my hair cut the other day. It gets shaggy pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And usually someone at the temple does it, but they left. So I went to the Clifford, and the girl, lots of piercings and tattoos and a crazy hairdo, which I all love them all, was doing a wonderful job. And I said, yeah, I told her that the people that usually did it so were gone, and so I needed to come to her. And I said, I'm from the temple down the street. Oh, she said, Buddhism. I'm a Buddhist. I mean, I'm not a formal Buddhist, but I really like karma. That makes sense to me. To go see her again. It's the way it is. Causes and conditions bring us to wherever we are in our lives. And students often come to me to talk. And we usually walk and talk. And they come to me with a longing for something other than the totality of their karmic situation. They are searching for holier ground than the ground under their feet. A spiritual home other than the one they already inhabit. I'm no different. Almost on a daily basis, I'm no different. My mantra often becomes, oh no, not this. Oh no, not this. There's a wonderful story that I first heard when I went on pilgrimage to Korea with my teacher, Venerable Samasuna, many years ago. And we happened to be at a monastery called Taeyongsa, Peace Temple. And he walked over to a building and he said, see right here? So we all went over and looked. And he said, there's a story about this building and this place. And it was that the abbot was walking around the grounds, kind of doing prevention consciousness to make sure everything was going all right. And he turned the corner, and right by this building, there was one of the monks peeing against the Buddha hall. And the abbot was appalled. And he said, monk, don't you realize this is Buddha land? You shouldn't be peeing here. He said, could you please tell me where it isn't Buddha land so I can go and have a good tea? Wherever it is, just this, just now, just here, it's our Buddha land. Even if there's a lot of pee around. Okay? Buddhism offers guidelines, moral guidelines, which we have heard earlier, the precepts. And of them all, not to harm, but to cherish all life, is the weightiest. But I think that there's another one of the guidelines that pervades our karmic situation and is most obviously applicable in our day-to-day ethical lives, than not to harm. And that is, speaking the truth, which is part of the Noble Eightfold Path, right speech. Right speech, and we see it. How many of you have heard of the Noble Eightfold Path? Oh, better still, how many have not heard of it? Okay, good. It's good to learn something new. The Buddha's first teachings were of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path was the path of cultivation to dance and live joyfully in our karmic situation, basically. And one of the Eightfold Path is right speech. And right, originally, is from a word that does not mean so much right as opposed to wrong, but means balanced or wise speech. And there are some guidelines. The Buddha said in the Middle Length Discourses, number 27, verse 13, so he provided some guidelines for what this wise speech is. And I would like to just tell them to you, and then we'll hone in on one. The first, giving up false speech and abstaining from false speech. One speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, deceiving nobody in the world. The first speech precept. The second, giving up malicious speech and abstaining from malicious speech. One does not create division between people by repeating what was heard in other contexts. Instead, one reunites those who are divided. One is a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, who speaks to promote concord. That's the second speech precept. The third, giving up harsh speech and abstaining from harsh speech. One speaks words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, lovable, that reach the heart, that are courteous and agreeable to others. Fourth, giving up gossip and abstaining from gossip. One speaks what is timely, fact, and good. One speaks to the truth and the life of truth with words that are timely, worth remembering, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. So that's a lot. Hard to remember. So those are the guidelines that the Buddha offers. And then there's just a few things about speech. Because most of us speak so much in our everyday lives, both verbally, including to ourselves, and in written communications, wise speech is crucial to building harmony, safety, kindness, and meaning. The second, for the majority of people, the stream of speech is so constant and so uninterrupted and so much under the influence of unskillful mental factors, many of them unconscious, that our four speech precepts are likely to be broken daily, if not hourly. Very interesting. In the texts, the discourses, the sutras of the Buddha, we find many reports of practitioners having the experience of awakening. If you read, you think, aha, wonderful and marvelous, I go for refuge, darkness has been dispelled. No. And then beyond that, besides going for refuge, awakening, just because of the way that a person spoke. And of course, in many situations, the Buddha kept silent. And that was pregnant. So, One of the things to do when you start to work with right speech is to take a speech inventory. And I decided, you know, it's hard to take a speech inventory of all of them, so I decided to start with truthfulness. And some of the aspects of truthfulness are factual accuracy, not minimizing and not maximizing, exaggerating. Turns out, I'm a big exaggerator. I shouldn't say big, because that's exaggerating. But in ways, all the time, I guess that's what it is, I'm a frequent exaggerator. See, I'm trying to be accurate. That I will say something that's just a little more than it really is. Well, sometimes I then have to look back, what is it that's in my mind here? And the other interesting thing that I found about my speech, this is embarrassingly truthful to me, is that before I say something, I always wonder, is this the right thing to say? And then while I'm saying it, I say, I wonder if this is the right thing to be saying. And then after I said it, I wonder, if now it's okay, maybe I should have said something else. So I have this lack of self-esteem sometimes with it. I just noticed actually more about other people. Isn't that interesting than I noticed about myself? And I would like to tell you just one story. It's about one of our priests in the Buddhist Society for Compassionate Wisdom who came to Ann Arbor to visit us. And the reason was that we're having a whole new accounting system and a whole way of doing the accounting, and that each temple has to get in the same place with it. You know, the chart of accounts needs to be adjusted, and the different bank accounts need to be, all in the interest here, right, I'm telling you of transparency, you know. And in Ann Arbor, we have been a little isolated from the rest of the Buddhist society. We have 5 temples. And so we get a little bit chippy. Why is this, and why is that, and don't you think it should be this way? And we have some ideas about how it should be done. And so this priest came to help us with this and to sit with our finance committee and to answer questions. And there was a lot of listening that she did. There was a lot of real interest in what committee members were saying. There was a lot of, on her part, of trying to be accurate with what exactly was happening so people would have a good understanding of it. And there was a lot of good humor. And the finance committee members who were representing the Sangha, that was pretty good. And when this priest left, I said, thank you so much. And she said, I didn't do anything. I said, yes, you did. And it will be passed on to our quirky Sangha who gets angry about this and that. It's so good to have that kind of thing where someone listened, when someone had a good sense of humor, was accurate in speech. It's wonderful. There are some specific communication practices. And I would like to share with you the other side of right speech, and that is good listening. And this is an invocation to the Bodhisattva of great compassion. It's really an invocation to the compassion which is innate within all of us. Would you sit with your back straight? Even with your eyes closed, conscious of your breathing, deepening it, because deep breathing usually means deep listening. We invoke your name, Bodhisattva of great compassion. We aspire to learn your way of listening in order to relieve the suffering in the world. You know how to listen in order to understand. We invoke your name in order to practice listening with all our attention and open-heartedness. We will sit and listen without any prejudice. We will sit and listen without judging or reacting. We will sit and listen in order to understand. We will sit and listen so attentively that we will be able to hear what the other person is saying and also what is left unsaid. We know that just by listening deeply, we already alleviate a great deal of pain and suffering in the other person. The next, I'm always giving a few guidelines. See if you can remember these. If you know something that is truthful and unhelpful, don't say it. If you know something that is untruthful and helpful, don't say it. If you know something that is untruthful and unhelpful,
don't say it.
Don't say it.
If you know something that's truthful and helpful,
don't say it.
Wait for the right time. One of my teacher friends used to say she did 23 years of training in the monastery, that her teacher, when she had some words to speak to her about, would take her for tea and cookies. And they would have wonderful time with the tea and cookies. And then the teacher would tell her what she had to say. But then my friend got a little suspicious every time she was taken for tea and cookies. It is about learning how to harmonize in situations. Wisdom. Restraint. Just right. Another thing is silence. Silence is something that most of us are uncomfortable with. But learning to be with silence is quite wonderful. It is so pregnant with wisdom and truth and allows us to pay attention in situations in ways that we wouldn't otherwise. So retreats are always good for that. Being around the temple is good for that. And some friends, some of our Dharma friends who right now live in Tucson, have a habit of every Saturday having a silent morning. And they make a little schedule for themselves. Could be done with one person or several, and they meditate when they get up. And I think they do a little yoga when they get up. And then they meditate, and then together, in silence, they prepare breakfast, eat breakfast in silence. Eating in silence is awesome. We see that we become the food that we eat. And then after breakfast, they do cleaning together. They have another time of meditation. This is between about 7 and noon or something. And then, you know what they do at noon? They go salsa dancing. I think they do a lot of that in Tucson. Maybe here too, eh? Yeah. So that how to have a little downtime from all the talking and all the TV and computer and multi-task devices takes us back to our original home. So listening, the guidelines, pain, silence, and I'm running out of time. Thank you for your patience. Oh, here's the last one, almost. It is to speak slowly. Have you ever done that with another person, just purposely slowed down in your speaking? Chogyam Trungpa, a great Tibetan, kind of controversial Tibetan teacher many years ago, used to purposely ask his students when they were in groups together and having discussions to slow down their speech. And although they had a lot of difficulty with it at first, it became a very intimate experience. I have an opportunity, because I'm deaf, I'm always telling people, please slow down. Not so much as that, but there's much more presence with what is said. I have a deaf friend who I finger spell to whenever I talk with her. Again, we don't talk so much, but it's very intimate. So I'm giving you all of these suggestions. My son-in-law came to my talk at the Ann Arbor Temple when I did something on rice speech. And he grew up in a Baptist family. And he said, at the church, they always just talk about this God here and God there, but the Buddhists, they get down to brass tacks in terms of, you know, how we speak to each other. Almost final story. This is a traditional one. There was a man. It could have been a woman. Let's make it a woman this time. There was a woman, and she was being chased by a tiger. And the tiger chased her to the edge of a cliff. She was very frightened. She scrambled. Actually, she looked down. And at the bottom of the cliff, it wasn't a really, really high cliff, there was another tiger looking up. So she was really stuck. So she scrambled over the edge of the cliff and hung on to some vines. She got her foot on a rock, and it was just very precarious. Then she looked up at the vines, and two small mice had crawled up. One was black, and one was white. And they began to gnaw at the vine that she was hanging from. Oh my God. There she was. And in that very moment, beside the vine that was being chewed, was a strawberry plant, a wild strawberry plant. And there was a small red strawberry right there. That's what to do with our karmic situation. One of our, and just so you, apparently the black and white mice are just about day and night. So time going by, and death imminent in her case, and in our case too, who knows? So that's kind of sobering. What am I doing with my life? One of the members in our Ann Arbor temple heard that story about the woman eating the strawberry. She teaches in Detroit. She's an art teacher, and she's a real character. Mm-hmm. She loved the story. Teaching in Detroit is tough. She said, I just go around looking for strawberries all day, don't you? I always bring out one of the old Korean masters at the end. It is not that we cannot do it. It is that we do not do it. And tonight, we've done some atonement. We've carried light. We can help ourselves, and by helping ourselves, we help others.